Webinar with Adam R. Welcome to 3PNR. I'm your host, Adam R., and with me on this episode is Barbara Baltome. Barbara, how you doing?
I'm great. How are you, Adam?
Good, good. Thanks for coming on and sharing your experience with us.
Yes, I'm excited that you invited me, and thank you.
So you've had a near-death experience, yeah?
Yes, I actually had two of them. I only remember one of them, but the other one was when I was a very small child, and I was told about it, that the death situation from an older brother when I hit in my 50s. So I didn't know about it all through my early life, but I obviously had all of the after effects that I've now learned about. And it was an interesting early life by having that at 18 months old.
What caused that early one?
That early one was caused, I went to, my brother ended up telling me about it, and it was high fever, and I went into convulsions, and my mom was pregnant with my little sister, and my older brother was 10 years older than me, so he remembers, and an older sister remembers the whole incident, but they were told by my parents not to talk about it. So I was not breathing, and I turned soft purple, my brother said, and my mom was told by my father yelled from, across the house. He was talking to the fire department, which there was no 911 back then. It was 1958. And he was talking to the fire department, who told my mom through my father to put me into tepid bath water and then to slowly add ice cubes to the water to slowly lower my body temperature so I wouldn't go into shock. And so both of my brothers were sent over to the neighbor's houses to grab more ice. And when he came back, he said, "You were just super soft purple. You weren't breathing. You were lifeless. Mom was holding you in the water and crying." And he said, just as the ambulance pulled up in front and we heard, the siren winding down and we knew that help was imminent, he said, "You came out of it." He said, "You arched your back and all of a sudden took a big, deep breath. And then you started crying and you turned bright red. And then the ambulance people came rushing through and took me off to the hospital. And I was gone 4 days." He doesn't know what I was sick with, but he said that I fully recovered and the parents never wanted to talk about it again. It was like, don't go there. Yeah. Huh. So I never knew about it. And I just had, an early life in my childhood and my teens and everything. I had incredibly strong, what we call intuition. And I would, immediately know that something was going to happen. And then I would, I learned to stop telling people that it was going to happen because it freaked people out so badly. And so I had to learn that. My mom especially would get freaked out about stuff. And so, And then when I was age 31, I had my second one and didn't find out what it was until about 12 years later. And a nurse friend ended up telling me what it was called, a near-death experience. And so now I actually travel and talk about it all the time. And I really want people to know what it is and how it affects your life and how it, changes your idea of death and consciousness and life itself. So that's what I do now.
I'd spoken to people before. You'll hear it throughout my podcast because I form a lot of theories. And when you do something to the brain where it's either damaged or air is cut off, no supply of oxygen or blood, the brain, like any other muscle, the body starts to compensate and might open up a chapter of it that you otherwise you wouldn't be using. So in that being said, I make room for the idea that I said this before, there's this guy got an accident, severe brain injury, could play piano out of nowhere.
Right.
And the brain's powerful. I say that it's the most sophisticated computer on planet Earth currently. So by you having that damage, maybe you opened up some sort of a part of the brain to start functioning that most people don't utilize.
Well, the way that I look at it is that the brain is like the Wi-Fi receiver, and that everything that's happening in your life is actually being processed, you know, through that Wi-Fi receiver, but that the information is out there, even though, I think the brain is just a tool of our physical body, but I think who we are is much bigger than our physical body, our brain, and anything that is physical. I really feel that instead of us being physical beings having this, you know, life here on Earth, we're basically beyond that. We're spiritual beings, or we're beyond the physical body, and we are in it having this experience here on Earth. But after we die, because I was still completely me after I died at age 31, and I was up on the ceiling above my body, and I was completely me, but I was not inside my body. I was having an out-of-body experience. I was looking down from the ceiling in the hospital during a myelogram, which is injecting iodine dye into your spinal cord. I had had a rupture of my L5 S1 disc in my back, and they were going to do laminectomy, discectomy surgery the next morning, but the neurosurgeon and the orthopedic surgeon wanted to do one last test. They'd done all the CAT scans and the PET scans and everything, x-rays and all the other stuff, but they decided to do one last test, so they had me come into the hospital the night before the surgery, and they were doing this myelogram, and unfortunately the x-ray tech that was administering the myelogram started just after they injected the iodine dye into my spinal cord. They just did a local. I wasn't under any anesthesia or anything. I was perfectly alert and awake. And they started tipping the table, and unfortunately he started talking to the other x-ray tech who had the monitor in front of him. And both the neurosurgeon and the orthopedic surgeon were in the room, and a female nurse was in the room, and nobody was really watching the table. And unfortunately, the x-ray tech started talking to the other x-ray tech, and he was pushing the wrong button on the table. So instead of raising my head and lowering my feet like he should have to make the iodine dye go down my spine with gravity toward the L5 S1 vertebrae, which is at the lower part of your spine, he was actually pushing the wrong button on the table, and he was lowering my head and raising my feet. He was tipping the table the wrong way. And so the dye that they just injected into the back of my neck area was going straight into my brain.
Did you get a payday out of this? Because that's a flop.
I didn't sue anybody.
What?
I didn't have a support system in my life at that time. And I actually think that the near-death experience was kind of planted at that time to help me get away from the very, very abusive husband that I was married to. And I had this really traumatic situation where I was married to an engineer, and he, didn't show those behaviors before I married him. And then once I married him, it started coming out, and then he would always apologize after he had done some sort of bad event. And
he was wearing a mask. Listen, everybody wears a mask when they first meet someone. Depending on the nature of who you really are is who you reveal later on, right? So
it was really traumatic. I was, I was trying to protect I had an 8-year-old son, and I had a 5-month-old baby daughter, and I was already protecting my son from the abuse, but I knew that I would eventually have to protect my daughter from it as well. And it was like, I was in this traumatic situation where I really couldn't afford to leave him. And I was trying to keep him happy in every way that I possibly could. And I was trying to meet all of his needs and all of his demands and everything else. And still he would fly off the handle and do an abuse situation. So he actually is the person who damaged my lower back. He was the one who caused the damage. So I was in this, traumatic situation. And it was really amazing, because I think it was planted to get me out of the marriage, because what happened was that immediately when the table was tipping the wrong way, I started feeling really funny, like, okay, am I supposed to feel like this? And I started feeling kind of like, you know, something isn't working right here. And I feel kind of funny, like I'm going to faint or something.
Yeah, that's an iodine. It's I worked in radiology, specifically in CAT scan.
Oh my gosh.
So that's crucial to monitor someone's vitals and make sure you're doing things right. The iodine's going, entering the body correctly. Every detail is crucial.
Yeah, they were talking about their weekend plans, the two x-ray techs.
Oh my goodness.
While I was tipping on the table. And so I didn't want to interrupt them. And the two doctors were like leaning against a wall talking to each other. And the nurse was over at a table. And I didn't really, I was 31 and I was just a little bit, you know, not really speaking up or anything. I wasn't that type. And so I laid there and I thought, oh, something's wrong. And I'm not sure. I feel like I'm going to faint. And by the time that I realized, okay, I need to tell these guys that something's wrong, I couldn't speak. I could think still, but I couldn't get my mouth to open up and do that. And then I couldn't reach my hand out to touch them. And then I started panicking and I was really, really scared. And I was just like completely, oh no, oh no, what's
going on? All the while, this is happening in your mind. They're unaware. Oh my God.
Yes, they were completely unaware. Everybody was completely unaware. And then I started hyperventilating, and that's when that triggered them to stop talking. Then the guy who had his finger on the button leaned over the x-ray table and looked in my eyes, and my eyes were rolling backwards, and I was trying really hard to make my eyes stay forward. And then he leaned back and he looked to see where his thumb was, and that was the last thing that I saw. I literally just shut my eyes at that moment, and I was up on the ceiling 1 second later, and I was looking down at my body and all of them and the equipment and everything in the room. And up on the ceiling, I wasn't at all panicked like I had just been in my body. I felt like I was all warm and wrapped in a loving blanket, and I was just cozy and fine. And I looked down and I went, huh, if I'm up here and my body is down there and that guy is calling code blue, I think I just died. I literally didn't have any panic at all. It was amazing.
You know, a lot of people are going to say, well, perhaps you had a chemical response and that's why you saw what you saw, but that doesn't really explain how you're looking at yourself.
And that I was able to watch all of their actions. He's calling code blue. They're all going into action. The nurse over at the table is starting to call for the defib unit. The two doctors are calling out orders. This lady comes in with an oxygen card. They put an oxygen mask on my face. Before that happened, both the guys, the x-ray techs, had jumped in to start doing CPR. One's doing chest compressions. The other's blowing into my mouth. I watched the whole thing from up above. And then finally, this guy came in and he had this small box and he put it on this shelf that was next to the x-ray table, and he started peeling these white things off of the backs of the white little circles. And I was up on the ceiling and I was completely calm. And initially what I started doing was I felt this being that was next to me. I felt this amazing, loving, like, oh man, it felt like I'd been connected to them forever, long before I was even on this earth. It felt like, oh my gosh, I'm so happy to be back next to this being. And I started saying to the being, I really need to go back into my life if I leave my children in this way. In other words, with my husband, they won't grow up to be the good human beings they're capable of being because of the abuse. And so I was saying that, and I was watching all the stuff that was going on down below. And what ended up happening was that the oxygen cart came in, and then the heart monitor came in. So that guy that had those little white things was putting them on me, and it was a heart monitor, but I didn't know that. So in the midst of saying to this being how much I wanted to go back, I was very calm about it. It wasn't panicky or I need to go back. It was simply, I need to go back into my life. And so when that guy put the heart monitor things on me and I didn't understand what he was doing, I hadn't really watched TV. I'm not really a TV person. And so I didn't really know what he was doing. And I said to the being, what is that he's doing? And immediately I was moved from the ceiling down right in front of the heart monitor box on the wall. I mean, on the ledge thing against the wall. And I watched his hand go between where my consciousness was and the box. And he reached over and he flicked this little toggle switch and the monitor went on. And this little green light at the top of the screen, there was a glass window thing, and it started traveling across the screen in a straight line, and I didn't know what it was. And I was watching this, and it was going beep, and I was watching this little green light go across, and I'm like, and so I watched it started again and went across the second time all the way across the screen. And then on the third time, it started to go across, and about a third of the way over, I don't know if the idea was planted into my head. I don't know if I just realized all of a sudden, but all of a sudden I went, oh, that's a heart monitor. My heart's not beating. And when I said that, then I was all of a sudden back up on the ceiling again, and the being again was next to me. And
were you able to see the being, or just you just felt the presence?
You know, I've been asked that before when I was on the NBC Today show. Now, Morales asked me that, and I said, you know, it's interesting. If I was standing next to my husband that I'm married to now, we've been married 29 years, and I knew that was him next to me, I wouldn't need to look over to see that it was him. I would know who he was. You know, it was like that times a million times over. I knew that being so well, I didn't even need to look over and see if there was any kind of light or a vision or, you know, physical or anything. I knew who it was, and I didn't need to see that. And so what I did, though, was start to say to him, I really need to go back into my life. And I said that about four times. And so then the neurosurgeon said to the orthopedic surgeon, too much time has passed. We need to do something. And so the orthopedic surgeon said, stand clear. And the guys that were around the table, the nurse was there, the lady with the oxygen cart, everybody stepped back. And he stepped two steps forward and he took his fist from behind his back and he arced it over his head and he pounded his fist right into my chest. It's called a precordial thump. I didn't find that out until years later. And he did the blow to my chest. I watched my body respond to it from up above. And right then when I watched that, then this voice said to me, and I'm assuming it was from the being that was up there with me. And it said this beautiful, I can't even imitate it very well, but it was like, but if you go back, you'll still be in your marriage. What will you do? And then I saw all these little film clips that just went flash, 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 flash.
Oh, memories. You were circling through memories.
All incidents of all these abusive moments that I'd had. And I'd been trying to forgive my husband. I'd taken him to a marriage family therapist, and he'd rejected that, wouldn't go after like three sessions. I'd taken him to a pastor of a church, again rejected. I'd written him letters, I'd begged him, I'd cried, I left him for a year. He told me he'd gone through counseling and resolved the issues. He had problems with his dad when he was younger with abuse. And so he said he'd resolved it, and he begged me to move back in with him and come back home. And I did that. And of course, within 3 months, he was back on his track of the abuse again.
Was
and
that,
so
was that fueled by alcohol or drugs, or is that just his
nature?
No,
nothing at all with alcohol or drugs. It was this just he would lose. He was, I think he was really stressed at work. He was an engineer, and I think he was really stressed at work.
Yeah, but stress, that's a crutch. I mean, if you're stressed out, go to the gym. You know what I mean?
Like, I know, exactly. But he would just, something I would, like, let's say if I put my phone down on the table and he had told me, don't ever put your phone on the table, and I forgot and I did it, then it could trigger him. He could literally hit me or kick me or knock me to the floor for doing something that I didn't mean to do. So that's where the abuse.
Yeah, something's not right with him at the chemical level.
Oh, right. You know, exactly. You know, oh my God. So my son was getting, you know, grabbed by the shirt. He forgot to put the lid. He put the lid like ajar on the garbage can one time, and he had taken the garbage out. My son was like 8 years old, and he'd taken the garbage out. Forgot to put the lid on like all the way down. And my husband went out in the yard in front of the children that he was playing with and grabbed my son and lifted him off the ground by the front of his shirt and said, you know, next time you put the lid on the garbage can. You know, it was simple things like that. You didn't mean to do it. He just had no control.
Yeah. So, and that doesn't get better. You know,
And I was trying so hard. And so I was shown all those little film clips of all of those damage moments. And then I was given all this time to kind of think about it. And I thought about all the things I'd try to do to help him change. And then after I thought of all those things, then I realized there's nothing that's going to happen. He's not going to change. And so then I said to the being, if you let me go back, I promise you that I will get strong enough to leave him. Because I'd really been diminished in my strength, of course, through all of that abuse. And so the second I said the word him, I will leave him. Then the doctor did the second precordial thump and smacked my chest again. And literally my eyes shut from up on the ceiling. And I opened my eyes and I had the oxygen mask on my face. And I spoke into the oxygen mask and I said, I mean, I'm looking all around at everybody's faces because all of a sudden I'm back in my body and I'm like, oh my God. And so then I said, what just happened into the oxygen mask? And the nurse leaned over me and said, stop, don't talk. We need to stabilize you. So I'm like sitting there for 20 minutes and they're like doing whatever they're doing to stabilize me. And then when they finally took the oxygen mask, they were all standing there. And the guy with the oxygen, the lady with the oxygen cart was still there. I'm assuming she's a nurse. The guy that had the heart monitor, the two x-ray techs, the neurosurgeon, the orthopedic surgeon, and the nurse that had been on the phone. So all those people are in the room, and they take the oxygen mask off, and I said, what just happened? I was up on the ceiling, and I could see and hear everything. And the neurosurgeon goes, oh, brother.
So he's heard this before. And
he didn't believe me at all, you know, obviously. And so I just then downloaded everything that everybody'd said and done. I literally said, and she said this, and he did that, and he was doing this, and you were doing this. And I completely, you know, pointed to everybody and said, what everybody just done. And while I was saying that, the neurosurgeon clenched his fist. He was standing right next to the bed and or the x-ray table. And he clenched his fist and he like pulled him up next to his chest. And he finally goes, I'm not going to stand here and listen to this. And he stormed out of the room.
Yeah, that's what happens when you put the abnormal in front of science, right? They don't make room for it.
But, you know, the orthopedic surgeon, he was really kind. He actually took my hand, and everybody else stayed in the room and listened. And he said, tell me again, what did you see? And what did you hear? How did you feel?
That's the neuro, right? The neurosurgeon?
Well, no. The neurosurgeon stormed out of the room.
Oh, yeah. I guess because you're compromising his belief system that he can fix it all. So, I guess that makes sense.
Absolutely. He has never. I've sent them a bottle of wine before, really nice bottle of wine, like, and then a card that said, you know, it's been 20 years since this happened. I know you remember it. I'd like to talk with you about it. If you'd ever like to talk with me about it, I'd be open to having lunch with you. And, you know, oh my gosh, I've never heard anything from the neurosurgeon. The orthopedic surgeon actually did talk with me, and he said, yes, I do remember it all. And yes, you did have a near-death experience. So he actually was open to it, but the other neurosurgeon was completely closed. And he actually has a really bad reputation in Santa Barbara, where I live, with his attitude with people. Yeah. So so he's, you know, maintained that through his whole years. But it was an amazing experience, and I didn't know how to acclimate to it. When I told my now ex-husband the next day, because they did the surgery the next morning, and then the doctors approached me in the recovery area, and as they were approaching me, I said to them, "Well, what was it that happened yesterday during that myelogram? What was that?" And the neurosurgeon put his hand up like, stop, you know, with his fingers spread out. And he said, "I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about your surgery." And so he never wanted to have any conversation about it. And then when I told my then husband, after he came, when I had been out of recovery and he came with our two children, he said, "Oh, that couldn't have happened. You probably hallucinated that." And so he was talking about the NDE part of it.
I find most people that question their own mortality and have a lot of doubt in their fidelity with life are the ones that are going to have more pushback, right? Because for them, the outcome's not going to be good for them. Circling back, what you said earlier about us having like a Wi-Fi, I'm glad you said that. The whole Wi-Fi thing, because that's a belief I have. I think the brain has receptors. Yep. It's at the end of the day, it's a really complex computer. Yep. I think the soul and our consciousness is one and the same. We're just made of energy. And the thing we live in, our body, is just a machine, right?
Exactly.
And like any other machine, as it ages, it's because parts are going to go bad. You know, the computer still wants to run, but it's not running at full capacity. I think in the future, though, especially with Elon Musk making this Neuralink, I think that might be a thing of the past soon.
We'll see. Really? I think he's a hero.
Yeah, that guy, talk about thinking out of the box.
Really? And, you know, who knows where he gets the information from? You know, there's so many things that can be coming from beyond us that, you know, maybe nobody's going to admit that they got it from someplace else. But I think that we're contributed to in amazing ways. And I think that's, you know, actually, I got a story for you. So when I was 9 years old, I had this dream, and my mom was sitting in at our, you know, dining room table. And I came in from the bedroom rubbing my eyes, and I said, "Mom, I had this really weird dream. I saw myself when I was an adult, and I was holding this little black like thing, and it was a television set, and it was also a telephone." I was holding an iPhone in my dream, and I didn't know what to call it, so I called it a television set and a telephone together. And my mom went at the time, "Oh, that's nice, honey, you know, and oh, that's good, you know." And then when the iPhones came out, I went, "Oh my God, that was what was in my dream." And so I'm talking on one right now.
So
I love it. So I wish I would have known.
I'm going to give you something. here's a theory of mine and a thought of mine. Like I said earlier, our soul and our consciousness, one and the same. If you look at the cosmic web, the way everything's connected, and you look at the human brain and imaging, you see how everything's connected. I have to believe that Earth is a proving ground. I say this a lot. I'm not trying to play a broken record, but just the more I talk to, you know, individuals like yourself, I'm starting to come to this conclusion. Earth is a proving ground. And if you don't get it right here, you get recycled, right? Because you don't get to go to the next level. You did a lot bad here, right? And you have to get recycled, and yet that's another chance. Or you're a great person and you get recycled because you're needed here instead of going to that next level. Now, that being said, you're a very pleasant person. Obviously, you're needed here. So maybe you got recycled. And think about what energy is. It's like if you look at fiber optic cables and how it sends information via light and energy, the information that you may have had in a different life might be attached to the energy that was, you know, recycled into whom you are currently. And that's perhaps one way you know these things.
That's right. I believe that. And I think that we come multiple times because there's so many things that are in my life that I have seen. Okay, so I have one of the people on my board of directors for my IANS group, which is the International Association for Near-Death Studies. They have groups all over the United States and across the world, and they are for supporting near-death experiencers, but also for expanding people's understanding of near-death experiences. And so I started the group in Santa Barbara, California, 10 years ago, and have run it and ever since. And I bring experiencers in from all over the place. Evan Alexander, who's a doctor from Harvard, Anita Morjani, all of the big names have all come to Santa Barbara. Who wouldn't want to come to Santa Barbara? But I'm lucky I live there instead of maybe Bakersfield or something. But so we have this wonderful group, and it's really this gift that that keeps on going all over the place, because people keep on contacting me that have come to these meetings and that have lost someone, or maybe they're just facing death themselves, or maybe they're just severely scared of death, and I get contacted all the time with emails and even across the world, because my near-death experience is on a documentary that's had like 700,000 views plus more. I'm not sure how many now by now, but it's people who say to me, you know, the story that you tell and the information that you give have been so beneficial to me in my situation, whatever their personal situation is. And I know that in my situation, it was helping me get out of that trauma of the abuse situation, but I didn't realize for years that it was actually my purpose. And I, you know, had a lovely career. I was Businesswoman of the Year in Santa Barbara, California, and I was also named at the university in Santa Barbara, California, the UC Santa Barbara, as an unsung heroine for all of the volunteer work that I did in the community. Well, those are great little titles, but I realized after being able to acclimate to my near-death experience and understanding it more through the IANS organization and also through Near-Death Experience Research Foundation, which is another online resource for people who want to read about near-death experiences or find out more about them, I was really able to see how what happened to me would help other people and would benefit the world. And so that's why I never mind talking about it and giving that out as a gift. And I'm hoping that people will accept that as a gift. And those people that don't believe it, it doesn't bother me at all, because I'm just hoping that they understand that I'm not making this up. I have, you know, medical records that this happened to me, and I don't have any reason. I don't get paid to talk about it. I actually travel and do all these talks all over the United States and in Canada, and pay my own way to get places to go do the talks. But it's really important for people to understand that the near-death experiences that are trying to give this information out to the world, we're just doing it to try to help the world to understand death a little bit better and not to be so fearful about it, and to understand that, you know, my feeling is we're here to do whatever good we can possibly do. And we're here to learn. We're here to grow ourselves. We're here multiple times to do that. And that's what I believe. And I've drawn that from my experience as well as all my life. So
yeah, you're bringing peace of mind to some people. And forget just peace of mind. It's considered a science. It's a needed science, right? Because a lot of people, I don't care who you are, you get to a certain point in life, you're going to question mortality. We all do it, whether it's in the form of nostalgia or it's that, you know, you don't want to let go. We're pure energy. And I'm starting to get the impression that you were repurposed. Does that sound about right?
Yeah, that sounds a perfect word for it. Repurposed is exactly it.
Yeah, you went into this thing in an abusive relationship. And what you were talking about earlier about the presence, I call that, some people call your guardian angel, I call them your social worker. You know, they're assigned,
I like that.
Yeah, they're assigned to you, right? That's your social worker when you have to transition or little hiccups in life. And so anyhow, your social worker makes you confront all the things in life that, you know, you're going to go back to this. And then when it comes to the point where you speak about your children and the well-being of them, it's like the social worker made a judgment call. Like, all right, well, maybe you're not ready yet. Let's send you back down there. And so you emerge from this
That's
repurposed in every way.
Yep. And my whole life took a completely different turn. So it took me 3 full years for me to safely get away from my ex-husband who was abusive. And I literally lived in pretty big fear for those years because my husband took out a really big insurance policy on me.
Wow.
And I actually thought that, oh my God, he's planning to do me away, however way that he could, that would make it look like it was an accident. And I didn't question that in his behaviors because he really had really traumatic behaviors, the way he acted. And so I finally got away. He was going off on a business trip to Montreal, Quebec, Canada. And I literally drove him to the airport and said, goodbye, honey. And I had been acting as though everything was okay and trying to keep everything calm. And then I went and found an apartment, moved out of the house, and I didn't take any of the stuff that, you know, like he would be problematic with. I only took my children's clothing and my own clothing and no beds, no furniture, no nothing.
So nothing that cops get into a tisk about.
Right, exactly. I was so scared that he was going to come down and kill me. And then the lawyer that I contacted said, I'm going to file a restraining order against him so that he can't come anywhere near you. The police will be able to protect you. And so then what ended up happening was that I was, you know, a single mom with an 8-year-old son and a little 5-month-old baby. Well, actually, she was 3.5 years by then. And so he was 8, 9 to 11. He was 11 and she was 3.5 years old. And so I had an apartment. And what I thought was, you know, I am never going to trust anybody in my life again. If that he could pretend that he was okay for the period of time till he got me and then act so bizarre and so, you know, angry in the other times that he would abuse me. I don't trust anybody out there. And so what ended up happening was that I thought, you know what, I need to know next time around if I'm ever going to let anybody in, I need to think of the character traits that I want in that person. And I'm going to watch and, you know, test them before I actually ever get together with anybody. And so I spent my evenings after the children were asleep and I got all my duties done, you know, lunch is made for the next day for school or whatever. And I would write down character traits that I thought of that were, if I thought of negative ones that my ex-husband had, I would try to think of what was the opposite one and I would only write down positives. So like he was abusive, so I would put patient, I would put loving, I would put kind. And so I had all these character traits I was listing. And then I started at work, I would watch people's behaviors and at my kids' sports events or, you know, any place that I was, I would look for character traits. So I had this list I was compiling for 2 years. And my current husband laughs at me because there were 206 things on this list. And wow. A couple of them were pretty funny because I had dated somebody in high school who was shorter than me and college and shorter than me. And he had had a big crush on me and other people told me, oh, he has a big crush. Well, we went to a dance and he laid his head on my shoulder. I'm 5'9". And so I was like, I don't think I can live this way. So I didn't date that person any longer. And I shouldn't have judged because of his height, but I did put on my list, must be tall. So I have this list of 206 things. And one day my son comes in and he has a girl from the neighborhood with him. It turns out that that girl from the neighborhood is now my stepdaughter.
Wow.
And her father, they put us together and made us go to the movies with them. They didn't tell either one of us that the other person was going. And they made us go to the movies. And then over the course of like 4 or 5 months, I just watched his behaviors. And he completely matched all of the things, including the must be tall, because my husband that I'm married to is an ex-NBA basketball player, and wow, he's 7 feet tall. So I got all of my, you know, things that I wanted. And that's also another thing that I want your people to think about, what they want in their life. If they, you know, spend the time to really evaluate in their work or their love life or whatever, what it is that they actually want and write that down. And then what I would say is I believe in God, obviously, because I think that's who was next to me up on that ceiling, some, you know, amazing being. And I felt that it was God. I would just say at night before I went to bed, I don't have the slightest idea who this person is that I'm writing these character traits about, but if you could bring them to me in a safe way so that I could, you know, be able to test them to make sure that it's this person, could you please, you know, work on that for me? And thanks a lot. And I'd go to sleep.
So you're asking your social worker.
That's great. Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That's great.
And you know, we do have social workers because, so I have this wonderful husband now, and we've 29 years we've been married, and we have 5 kids, his 2, my 2, and then our baby together. And so about 5 years ago, I was going up to San Francisco to talk at about 4 different locations up there about my near-death experience. And we were driving back down to Santa Barbara, and it's about a 5.5-hour drive. And we were about 30, 35 miles north of Santa Barbara. And it's this where the freeway comes from inland and it hits the ocean. And then it starts heading southbound along the ocean to get to Santa Barbara. And it's called the Gaviota Coast. And there's a lot of really big wind situations there because there's this big gully that the highway comes through. And so we were coming through that area at about 9 o'clock at night. And as we went around the corner that comes up that you're starting to head southbound along the ocean, it was all of these huge gusty winds that were happening. And this one big gust hit the side of our Toyota van, and my husband was driving, and I had been kind of laying back in my seat with my, you know, bare feet up on the dashboard of the van, and I was just, you know, relaxing, waiting to get home. And I watched as my husband could barely, even though he's 7 feet tall and a big, you know, big guy, he was barely keeping the van under control because the wind was just buffeting and pushing the van, and he was fighting it with the steering wheel. And so then after the gusts ended a little bit and it was still windy, but I said, hey, why don't we not go 65? Because that's kind of dangerous. Let's slow down to 50. Do you think that's okay? And he goes, yeah, that's a great idea. So he slows down to 50. And I'm thinking, okay, we're safe, and you know, we're going slower, we're okay, and the wind's still blowing. Well, all of a sudden, in my ear, I literally heard a voice say, "Danger! Big impact ahead! Danger! Big impact!" And I kind of freaked out because I was like, "Okay." So I sat up in my seat and I made sure my seatbelt was nice and tight. I put my feet on the floor. And then I turned and looked at my husband. I said, "You know how sometimes I hear from the other side?" And he said, "Yeah." And I said, "Well, I just heard danger, big impact ahead, danger, big impact." And so I said, "I think we need to slow down a little bit more, maybe 30 miles an hour." And he said, "Barbara, we're on the freeway." And I said, "Well," I turned and looked through the back of the van and I said, "There's nobody behind us. Nobody's going to care whether we're doing 30. If you see somebody coming up, catching up to us, then, you know, you can go ahead and speed up to 50 if you think that's good. And then slow back down to 30 because we're going to need time to stop. Something up ahead is really dangerous." And he goes, "Okay." It's really good that he's seen these things happen to me before where I know what's going to happen. And so he believes me. This husband believes me. If I'd ever told that to the previous husband, there's no way that he would believe me.
Punch again. Yes.
But yeah, so we were going along at 30 miles an hour and the wind's still blowing and buffeting and everything. And we come around this corner and way up in the dark, way up in ahead of us is one single police car's lights that are, you know, twirling around. And I felt immediately, oh, that's where the danger is. And as we were approaching it, going 30 miles an hour in the slow lane, the first thing I noticed was that the police car wasn't off the freeway. It was actually stopped in the slow lane, and we were going to have to change lanes to the fast lane to go around it. And I was looking for the policeman saying, "Well, what is the situation here? What's going on? Why would he stop in the slow lane?" And there was no policeman. I couldn't see within the range of his lights, and there's no street lights out there. It's all really rural. And so I was really like, "What's going on? What's going on?" And then my husband started to change lanes to go over into the fast lane to go around the police car. It's maybe 30 yards behind the police car. And all of a sudden, that being that was helping me, what do you call it? You said it was called my guides or something. I don't know what you called it, something cute.
Oh, the social worker.
Social worker. Yeah. Okay, yes. My social worker grabbed, no kidding, grabbed both my upper arms and nose to nose with my face. I actually saw the flash of the face and they screamed, miles an hour. And I was so freaked out that they touched me, like grabbed my upper arms, and that face thing happened, and that they screamed, that I echoed it, and I went 10 miles an hour. And Victor slowed from 30 to 10. And just as we got level next to the police car, we're in the fast lane, they're in the slow lane, we just slid maybe 20 feet past it, and our lights finally lit up. The semi truck that had tipped over on its side, blocking both lanes of the freeway, and the cab of the truck was directly in front of us in the fast lane, which is where the gas tanks are. And so we were able, because we were doing 10 miles an hour, to go off the left side of the freeway and go around the truck. And as we did, I looked up on top of the truck as we got to the far side of it, and the police officer was standing up on top of it, talking through the window to the trapped truck driver who was inside. That's why no cars ever caught up to us. They had closed the freeway behind us. We were between the closure and the truck, and we got helped through that situation. And literally, I started saying thank you, God, thank you, thank you, thank you, and for the truck driver's life, for the police officer's life, for mine, for Victor's. And so then, about 10 minutes later, my husband had been completely quiet, and he goes, Barbara, how are you able to do that? And I said, Victor, it's not me. It's the other side, whatever you want to call them. They want to help us. And if we listen, then we get help. But we have to understand that they're there so that they can help us. And so, you know, I think that if everybody understood that, yes, there is that social worker out there, and that if you need help and you understand that they're there, whether you want to call it intuition or you want to call it intervention or whatever word you want to use, you can get help, and it is there, but you just got to understand that they're there and they do want to help. And there's certain situations where maybe it's your time to go, and maybe you're not supposed to get help. It's your, you've already, you know, designated a certain date and a location to die at or something. I'm not sure how it all works, but I don't think, you know, we all get help every time, but I certainly have had the most amazing experiences with what I call the other side, or my social workers. And you know, it's been a pleasure to know that they're there and to be able to get that kind of help and understand that, you know, it's available. So
you gotta imagine that something happened that, like I said earlier, where your brain compensated for damage and opened up a new channel, a new receptor, right? A brand new receptor in the brain's working now. So you can now perceive things. I say this a lot too in the past.
Yeah.
So, I mean, your life story is a good movie. And it's weird too. You're a Barbara. You live in Santa Barbara, which means Saint Barbara, right?
I know. And at Christmas time, I call myself Santa Barbara.
That's great. So
that's kind of fun.
So prior to this incident, prior to any of this happening, the near death, did you have a religious perspective?
Well, you know, when I was a child, my parents did not go to church. My grandmother was religious, but she lived 50 miles away, and I didn't have that much, you know, connection or contact with her. And I mean, I saw her and stuff, but it wasn't like we lived right next door or, you know, close by or anything. Back then, 50 miles was a long way, long ways. And so what I did was, at about age 5, my little sister was 3, and my parents enrolled us. Back then, you didn't have preschools where they weren't connected with the church. There was just a preschool at this local Methodist church. Oh, it was Baptist church that was down maybe half a mile from our home. And so I went during the week, you know, to this preschool, because I'm probably sure my mom wanted time off. And so on Sundays, what I would do is take my little sister, who was only 3, and I was 5. And back then, you didn't question whether your kids were, you know, my parents actually let us go out that door dressed up for, you know, Sunday school. And we walked a half a mile through neighborhoods and stuff to get down to this little Baptist church. And it wasn't because I felt the connection to the church other than I went to preschool there. It was because, to me, it helped me to feel like I was connected to maybe the spirit that had helped me through that situation that I didn't even know about when I was 18 months old, it made me feel connected to something that I felt bigger, that was bigger than me. And I felt love there that I just, I don't know, I felt comforted by going. And I didn't care about, you know, then when we were older and we went there like first or second grade or something, and they would try to have us, you know, read, you know, you have to read this part of the Bible. The Bible never interested me at all. It was the, you know, like the cord that went straight up to God that I felt that I had. It was this feeling that he's never far from where I was. And I always felt really safe. Now, fast forward to me being 17 years old. I'm grown up. My parents have divorced. I work for the newspaper in Salem, Oregon, where I grew up. I'm a photographer, and I've been taken on by these two really famous, well-known photographers that are the newspaper's photographers as an apprentice. And I'm a girl. These two guys took me on. I was really impressed that they took me on instead of some boy, because back then, you know, the boys were always shown more, they got more of the good stuff. So I was working also in the circulation department, answering calls and delivering newspapers. When the newspaper person who was delivering had missed a newspaper, I would go out in the company truck. And now I was doing lots of things for the newspaper. And then one day I was riding my bike over to go to work, and I'm coming across this bridge across the Willamette River. And one of the bridges, there are two of them, goes from West Salem, where I lived, over to the main part of Salem. The other one goes from the main part of Salem back over to West Salem. Well, I was going on that bridge that was going back over to West Salem, and it is not the main bridge, and it has really thin little sidewalks, and it has like maybe 3 foot wide sidewalk. It's really, really, and so everybody usually uses like the other bridge, but for some reason I decided to go across that bridge that day. And so I'm riding across it, and all of a sudden, and I'm 17 and I'm on my 10 speed, you know, and I want to look cute. I'm obviously attracted to the guys out there, right. I don't want to look like a dork. I literally felt like a pressure on the back of my head, pushing my head down over my handlebars like a 10-year-old kid would ride their bike with their, you know, scrouched down over their handlebars. And I'm like fighting it, going, no, I'm not doing that. And I was pressing against, you know, the pressure on my head, but it was so strong that my head ended up down over my handlebars. And right as I got down over my handlebars, this big truck comes lumbering up behind me. I didn't realize it was coming because it was behind me, and it had this really extended side mirror, and the side mirror literally brushed over the back, because my head was down so far, over the back of my head, and it literally touched my head. And then as I it raised my head, because the pressure went off as it was receding, you know, beyond where I was on the bridge, I saw the mirror and I realized, oh my God, if I'd been upright, that would have hit me right in the middle of my back and knocked me off my bike.
You know, when you finally do go to the other side, your social workers are gonna be like, you know how much work you put me through?
I know. I know. Well, I stopped on that bridge and like literally started crying and said, you know, thank you for helping me. I really appreciate it. I was talking to social workers, God, whatever you wanted to. Right. But I realized in that moment that I had just been, you know, kept from a very terrible outcome. And I knew in my life, all through my early years and all through all my whole life, that, you know, that kind of help was there. And when it showed up and I got those kind of wonderful moments, I was always grateful, and I always said thank you, and I always felt like, you know, I love you guys and I appreciate you. And so I just wish, you know, it doesn't have to be go to church. I mean, I'm not saying that people can't go to church, because that might be the way that they feel most comfortable, and I love that. That's good for them. For me, it wasn't. It was just this, you know, straight up connection that I felt, you know, the beauty of my social worker, my angels, whatever you want to call it, and that beautiful spiritual being that I felt that was next to me on, you know, when I was on that x-ray table and my heart was stopped for 10 minutes. I just wish everybody understood that. And it
comes down to people. It comes down to people acknowledging it, right? Cause a lot of human beings have this habit of focusing on the negative in everything, not even just this subject, everything. If you ever want a good example of how mean-spirited people could be, is go on social media and write down a positive message. And I assure you, there's going to be some negative messages mixed in with that. I mean, people...
I feel so sad about that. I don't even read them. And then when you see the people out there on the highways driving around, you know, being mean to others in their cars and stuff, I'm like, oh, gosh. But if I could only tell people that when you do something good for someone else, whether it be open the door for somebody or, you know, pay for somebody's coffee at Starbucks that's behind you that's never going to see you again, it is such a joy for your own heart when you start focusing on finding little ways to make like somebody else happy for a moment. It is so beautiful for your own heart. You will never live the same again if you find that in your life. Oh my God. I literally absolutely love finding little tiny ways to bless people or whatever.
I have this way of life, the way I look at life anyway. If you want a race, human. If you want a religion, humanity. And if you want a place to call home, Earth.
It really shouldn't
be that easy. I would think it would be.
Yeah. Well, I always say that I don't believe there's heaven or hell. I just believe it's home. It's where we came from. It's where we return to. And the O part of it, I make it into a heart because it's only filled with love and we're accepted there and we're not judged. I felt no judgment and nothing but acceptance when I was out of my body. There wasn't any, you were bad to your sister last week or, you know, anything weird like that. I mean,
well, see, you're a good person, right?
Well, no, I sometimes are bad.
All right. When you say you're bad because you took a piece of candy, it's different. I'm talking about when cereal
flipped somebody off on the freeway.
I mean, we're all going to do that. That doesn't make you a bad human. I'm talking about a serial killer. When a serial killer dies,
I'm not bad like that.
Yeah, that guy's social worker is not going to be on the pleasant side of things, right?
that social worker has a big job to do. Yeah. My mom was a police officer and she was also a tower guard at the correctional institution in Salem, Oregon. And so I watched as she started that when I was about 13, and I watched, through my 20s and everything, she was working with all the, and I watched as it hardened her into this really, really hardened heart person. And I felt so bad for her that she was exposed to people that would do that to her. I really felt bad that happened.
She got desensitized. That's unfortunate. You know, that happens. Yeah. That happens in medical too, by the way. A lot of medical people become desensitized.
Yeah.
So before we close, you have a program you put together, right? For the study of near death.
Well, I have an IANS group in Santa Barbara, California, and then I basically refer everyone to the IANS website, which is IANS, as in David, S. IANS, which is International Association for Near-Death Studies.org. And I refer people to that if they want to know about near-death experiences. And I also refer them to the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation website, which is NDERF.org. And there's so much information, so many NDEs that have been written up, and there's so many similarities. There's after effects of what the after effects are. There's so much research that's been done by the University of Virginia, their Division of Perceptual Studies, Dr. Bruce Grayson, Dr. Raymond Moody, who first did the book Life After Life in the 1970s and first named it near-death experience. It probably should have been death experience, but he didn't. You know, it was new and he was, you know, cutting ground with all this. So I'm friends with all of these people now and they're like my family. And it's just beautiful to have the connection to all of these people and have the thought of helping everyone else out there in the world to help understand this and take fear away from death, you know, just have people understand it's just transitioning home. We're just going home.
That's fantastic. You got a fantastic story. I mean, I sat here just listening. Like, this is actually great. It was great.
I thank you so much. Well, you know, I sometimes before I even talk on a podcast, I just say, you know, hey guys, just plant the words in my mouth and help me to help others. And that's all I'm asking you to do. So sometimes, you know, that's what happens is it just comes through and I'm able to just talk fluently. And I feel that they want me to do this. And so I feel, you know, the gift is here and I'm giving the gift away. So
well, I think it's great. I mean,
I think what you're doing is great too.
I appreciate it.
Aww, well, thank you so much. Barbara, I really,
it has been great saying that. It's been great talking to you. Absolutely good. Great.
And if anybody wants to email me, they can. And I get emails from all over the world. And my email address is sunny, like sunshine, S-U-N-N-Y. And then S-B, standing for Santa Barbara, where I live, and then Barbara, my first name. So sunnysbbarbara@gmail.com. And I don't mind getting emails, and please just nice ones. The ones that are the bad ones that are saying mean things, I can live without that.
That's terrible. Well, Barbara, yeah. Again, I'm going to have you on again soon. There's more we need to talk about. In the meantime, you have a good night, sweetie. And thank you for being on.
You too. Big hugs and blessings to all. Okay. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Bye-bye.